Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we talk about raised beds. They can solve all kinds of problems in the garden. And we have with us author and YouTube host, Callie Kim. We're talking to her about her new book. It's titled Raised Bed Gardening, All the Know-How You Need to Build and Grow a Raised Bed Garden. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. Any questions about planting, building, or filling a raised bed? Maybe you already have one and have questions about the one you have. Join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Kim, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry. I really appreciate it. I hope you're not getting too much snow out there.
No, today it looks pretty nice out there. Well, it's cold, but no snow, at least in southern Wisconsin. Plenty in the northern part of the state. Oh, man. Well, you weren't always a gardener, I don't think. Tell us how you got started.
Well, I actually grew up gardening. As a child, we had 5 acres and a family of 10 kids, believe it or not. And as you can imagine, our grocery bill was pretty high. So my parents put us all to work planting seeds, growing vegetables, and my mom canned and froze and preserved everything. But I love gardening now, but as a kid, as like a 7 or 8 year old kid, I had these endless rows of beans I had to pick, and I wasn't too excited about it. But as an adult, you know, you kind of come back to your roots sometimes, right?
Yeah.
And we had a couple of kids of our own, and I wanted my kids to enjoy the taste of those homegrown vegetables. And, you know, things, I didn't want to eat all the pesticides and chemicals on foods in the grocery store. So as an adult, I kind of got back into it and just really fell in love all over again with it.
How did you discover raised beds?
Well, we actually, our house is on a hill and that slopes down from our house. So there wasn't a lot of growing space to begin with, but we actually, crazy enough, we were on a backyard TV show. We lived here in Southern California, and they came out and actually digged some tiers into our hill, and then we ended up kind of making raised beds out of those tiers in order to be able to have more growing space. But even before that, I had planted a garden the year before, but just didn't have a lot of space to do it. And the raised beds allowed me extra space to be able to grow vegetables in a spot that I wouldn't normally be able to do it.
Yeah, that's a great benefit. What are the other benefits of raised beds?
I think one of my favorite benefits of all, and I've seen this over and over again, is that you can really control the soil that goes into your raised beds. You can plant it packed full of all kinds of great, high fertility types of soil, which makes your vegetables just grow that much easier. So no matter how much space you have, big yard, small yard, no yard at all, you can plant and fill a raised bed to fit your space and grow vegetables no matter where you live.
I really like your book a lot. Maybe tell us a bit about it. What did you want to accomplish with it?
I think what I just mentioned, I think, is really kind of my goal is a lot of people think I don't have space to grow vegetables. And really through this book, I wanted to explain and really give people the nitty gritty and the tools that they need to grow vegetables no matter where they live, no matter if they have a small garden, a big garden, and really make it doable for people. You don't have to, have a lot of experience or even know how to, have a lot of construction skills in order to be able to build and grow in a raised bed. So just to get it out there, keep it simple. That's kind of my garden motto. Just start simple, and then you can expand and grow from there. So really just to make it accessible and easy for anyone to grow vegetables.
I really like the book. The photos and then the instructions are easy to follow.
Wonderful. That was exactly my goal. The photos actually were taken all by my family. My husband also works with me in our business, our gardening business, and he took a lot of the photos, as well as my daughter. She's a photographer, and I took some of the photos as well. So it was really fun to work on this book as a family and then see how it came out and hear all the wonderful stories about people who are able to grow their vegetables as a result.
So you say in the book we need to plan before we jump into a raised bed gardening. What's the first thing to ask yourself?
Well, I really encourage people to ask themselves how much time do they have to devote to a vegetable garden, because that's really going to determine how many raised beds that you build or plant. So, you know, if you're a very busy person and maybe just have a few hours a week, you might want to just plant one or two raised beds. If you've got lots of time and you have lots of space, you might want to plant 8 to 10 raised beds. But you definitely want to consider the time that you have and the space that you have. And also, if you want to kind of just mainly supplement your, you know, your grocery budget or your, you know, going to the grocery store supplement with your food, or if you really want to be self-sufficient. So that will really determine how many raised beds you build and whether you're going to build them in a small space or really, you know, in a large space.
Yeah, and the size, you know, within your book, you talk about raised beds of a number of different sizes, actually, and types.
Absolutely. That's the wonderful thing about raised beds is you can really customize it to fit your space or your growing conditions. So, you know, you can build a 2x4 raised bed, which is a fairly small size. If you've got like a deck or a patio, you don't even have to have a grassy area or a backyard, a typical backyard. You grow a small raised bed on a deck or a patio. Or if you don't want to bend over, if you've got back issues, or maybe you just want to save your knees or your back, or maybe you're a person with disabilities and is not able to, you know, get down in the garden, you can build a higher one or an elevated one to fit whatever needs or whatever space that you have. So it's really, raised beds really make gardening accessible for anyone and easy for anyone to grow in.
Emily in Appleton, Wisconsin, emailed us to ask if you can talk about raised garden bags. She's thinking using two or three of these 50-gallon bags for... Or she's been thinking of using them for a couple of years.
Absolutely. Those are actually one of my favorite things to grow in. If you don't want to take the time to build a raised bed, pop-up raised beds or fabric raised beds are a super easy way to grow. They take minutes to pop up. I use a brand called Smart Pots, and the fabric is super durable. It's aerated, and it comes all folded up in a package, so it's very compact. You can pack it away in the wintertime if you don't want to have it out in the garden. But literally, you just pop it up, fill it with soil, and plant your vegetables. And you can install drip irrigation if you want. But it's a super easy way, especially if you're growing in a small space. They come in all kinds of different shapes, colors, sizes. Really, the sky's the limit with that. So I'd say if you're looking for super, super simple and quick, that's definitely a great way to grow.
Well, let's talk about some of the other options for the material you use to build the beds. Treated wood, an option or not?
Well, the wood that's treated these days is a lot safer than how it was treated in the old times. If you want to completely stay away from treated wood, treated wood will last you longer. But if you want to completely stay away from treated wood, there's all kinds out there on the market. So you just kind of have to, you know, see what's important to you, what matters to you. If that's not an issue for you, then go ahead and get the treated wood. I myself prefer to use untreated wood. There's lots of very durable types of woods that will last you for years. So, and there, you could also use like those concrete blocks. You could use a composite wood if you don't ever have to, you know, need to worry about it decomposing or breaking down over time. There's so many different options out there. And in my book, I detail out kind of the pros and cons of each. So then you can make the decision what works best for your situation.
Yeah, and I like how you have photos that show the plants growing within the various options. So you can kind of see how it looks and how it might look in your own backyard.
Sure. Yeah. It's always great to visualize. We're all very visual people. And I love not only seeing the written words, but seeing the pictures too. And that was one of our goals with the book, is just to make it super visual, super colorful, just really fun for people to look at and read, even for kids to flip through and just look at the pictures.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, in the end of all those photos, along with some good writing, inspire. I think they're kind of inspirational. By the time you're done looking through the book, you think, oh, I got to do this.
Well, thank you. you. That was exactly my goal. I really want to encourage people to do it and really be their cheerleader. That's what our YouTube channel is all about, our books are all about, and all the products we have on our website. We just want to be able to make it easy for people and let people know that you can do it.
Should we line the beds?
You know, again, that's really an individual decision. It kind of depends where you're putting it. For example, if you're placing it on concrete, you may not necessarily need to line it because you're not having a lot of weeds come through. But if you're placing it on an area where you might have weeds coming through, I always line the bottom of my beds if I'm placing it on soil or a grassy area. My initial layer I put down is cardboard just to smother the weeds. And it really helps kill the weeds. It helps prevent them from coming through into your soil. If you're planting a raised bed that might have some, you know, little cracks in it or something like that, you may want to lay down like a landscape fabric or something like that just to prevent the soil from running out, especially if it's an elevated raised bed. So, you know, in my book, I talk about liners and then kind of give some guidelines as to whether or not you want to put a liner in the particular bed that you're building. Of course, the fabric raised beds are easy. They already have that built right in there. And because they have good aeration and drainage in the fabric, the water will drain right through, which you really need for your vegetables, and also helps aerate the roots. So the roots, you know, get more oxygen and it helps you grow more vegetables as well.
Joe in Washburn emailed a question relating something we were sort of talking about. He would not use treated lumber. For him, that's out of the question. He's thinking about using pine or oak and then burning the outside surface of the boards prior to installation. Japanese builders do this all the time to increase the life of boards exposed to harsh elements of weather and below grade applications. Would charring create any kind of negative effect in his soil? And any other suggestions for long-lasting construction materials related to the perimeter enclosure?
You know, I've never done the charring situation that you're talking about, so I really can't speak from experience to that. I don't see it causing a lot of big problems, but that would be definitely something if he's looking into, he would want to, you know, do some more research on for that. But I've used pine. For most of my raised beds are out of pine or Douglas fir, which are very long-lasting. I've had some last, you know, 10 years or more. Now, granted, we don't live in a super humid climate. If you live in a climate where you get lots of moisture, we've gotten a ton this year in Southern California, but typically we don't, then you want to maybe look into some more sturdy woods like cedar that will be more longer lasting. But if you want to totally stay away from treated, then, you know, definitely look into those other options like that and, you know, research it and find out if that's going to work best for you. I always tell people experiment. You know, play around with things, see what works best for you, and then you can always adjust as you go. If your experiment didn't work, there's no failures, there's only learning opportunities. So it always is a great way to learn.
Kelly Kim, our guest today, her book is titled Raised Bed Gardening, All the Know-How You Need to Know and Build and Grow a Raised Bed Garden. Questions for her, you can give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Jill Nadeau is our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Kelly Kim. Kim's the author of the book Raised Bed Gardening, All the Know-How You Need to Build and Grow a Raised Bed Garden. And so we can talk about raised beds. She has, of course, knows a lot about vegetables as well, so you could ask your vegetable questions too. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Tim in Hollandale, we'll go to you. Tim, thanks for calling.
Hi. I just had a comment. I had me and a couple friends were in construction, so a lot of times we'll build stuff out of old construction, like barn boards work good, old roofing barn tin, that works good for the sides. And then I know you had a question from a lady about 50-gallon garbage bags. Last year I grew potatoes and two tomato plants in the 50-gallon garbage bags. So they were good too, so.
Sam, thanks for calling. Comment, Kim.
I think it's great if you can find some ways to repurpose wood. It kind of gives your garden a really fun, kind of whimsical look if you're using that old barn wood. And of course, it saves you money, saves the environment. So any way you can repurpose, I'm all for that. And again, like experimenting with 50-gallon garbage bags, that's absolutely wonderful. If you can grow food, any way you can grow food, especially these days, and save on your grocery bill, I'm all for. So way to go, Tim. Way to be innovative and creative with how you're growing.
Yes, absolutely. Betsy in St. Paul, Minnesota, on to you now. Hi, Betsy.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
Yes, I was just wondering if the host had any tips on growing kumquats.
Kumquats.
I have actually never grown kumquats. So that would, again, be something to experiment with, do your research on, and find out how to grow it. Grow them, but, man, they are just delicious. So go for it.
Okay. Betsy, thanks for calling. Jean in Ironwood, Michigan, your turn. Hi, Jean.
Yeah. Hi, Larry.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I was on Facebook the other day on Marketplace, just scrolling through to see where I could waste my money buying stuff. And anyway, there's a guy in Wisconsin who's building raised beds out of 55-gallon barrels, food-grade barrels, and he builds 2x4 framework to set them in. He used treated wood, but I suppose you could use anything. And I was just wondering if that would be a good idea, because he makes them 2-foot high and 3-foot high, different heights for people who have different,
abilities.
Whatever they want as far as height.
Yeah. 55-gallon drums. Food grade.
Wow. I love it. I love hearing all these creative ideas. And I'd say, again, definitely experiment, go for it. You do want to make sure, it sounds like he's planting directly in the food barrels and then supporting them with the landscape timbers or what have you.
Yeah.
I would definitely make sure that you drill plenty of holes in the bottom of those for drainage. You want your plants to have plenty of drainage, and if he's putting them right on soil, you could even knock out the bottom of those if that's possible to do without splitting the barrel, but definitely put drainage in it and fill it with a really good well-draining soil, which I have lots of soil recipes in my book. So you don't want those plants to get waterlogged in a plastic barrel like that. That's always that potential, or to get overheated. So lots of holes, even holes possibly in the sides, depending on how he's situating the barrels and the location that he has them in. But wow, what a fun way to grow food.
Yeah. Gene, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Well, you can join in, too. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Jeannie emailed to say that chipmunks, squirrels, and rabbits are terrible for him. Anything he grows is quickly ravaged by critters. Does he just need to encase the raised beds in fine netting? Determined chipmunks seem to get past all security measures. So he wonders if you have any great ideas.
That is a tough one. I'd say that's probably the biggest issue that I hear from gardeners all over the world is squirrels and chipmunks, particularly. Somewhat rabbits, but those squirrels and chipmunks are super persistent and very aggressive. What I do, I do encase a lot of my containers and raised beds, or not so much my raised beds, but some of my special plants I'll wrap in netting or the tulle fabric, which is kind of like a netting fabric, but it's very inexpensive. You can get it at most fabric and craft stores. So I'll do that for some of my special plants. Unfortunately, I can't do that for my whole entire garden. I know that I have a friend who lives near me, kind of in the hills, has a huge squirrel problem, and he ended up pretty much building a fence around his garden. So if it's a huge, huge issue, or if deer are an issue, that's something to consider. I realize that is an investment. However, you can also spray make a, kind of DIY spray out of hot peppers, boil them, even throw some garlic in there, because they don't like the smell of like garlic, hot peppers, anything you can think of that, is hot and spicy. throw in there, boil it down, make a kind of a hot pepper DIY spray, and then spray it in those areas where the squirrels or the chipmunks or the critters might visit. It's not a guarantee, but at least it'll help deter, and maybe along with your other tool and netting, deterrence, it will help keep them away so you have some more vegetables for yourself.
Ted and Spooner back. Ted, hi, you've got something about those drums, that the 55-gallon drums.
Yeah?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Them 55-gallon drums, if you cut them in half, they're kind of deep. If you cut them long ways, you got less dirt and more room to plant stuff.
All right. So he cuts the drums sideways.
Great idea. Love hearing all these ideas flow around.
How much depth do you need for, most of these raised beds in terms of the soil?
Well, it really kind of depends on what you're planting. The typical raised bed is probably about 12 inches high. If you're placing it on top of soil of some kind, then a lot of times those really aggressive roots can get down in the roots into the soil a little bit deeper. I personally like to plant mine a little bit deeper, or to build mine a little bit deeper, maybe 2 to 3 feet high. It kind of depends, again, on the space that you have and the type of vegetables that you're growing. There's some vegetables that have very deep roots, like tomatoes, watermelon, that really enjoy the deeper amounts of soil. But if you're growing things that have shallower roots, like lettuce, greens, herbs, then a nice shallow raised bed will do just fine. And I have some great guidelines there in my book on the type of vegetables you're planting and the ideal depth for raised beds for those particular vegetables. So it's all in there for you.
Nancy in Appleton, we'll go to you. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I am just asking about raised beds.
Okay.
I try to do organic gardening, buying organic seeds, trying to use organic fertilizer or whatever. And I'm concerned. I want to go to raised beds, but I'm concerned about the materials. I don't know how to get materials that would also be safe and more organic for raised beds.
Well, Nancy, the fabric raised beds that I use are actually specifically designed for growing vegetables. They're made by Smart Pots, and they are a completely safe way to grow vegetables. However, if you want to build a raised bed, a lot of the woods out there, the chances that any of, first of all, don't buy treated wood if you're really concerned about that. But, you're buying wood that, like pine and Douglas fir and things like that. And the exposure as far as that goes to your vegetables is minimal. And you're going to be absolutely just fine. But if it is a concern for you, I would go with those fabric raised beds that are specifically designed for, for growing vegetables.
And you can take a look at those fabric raised beds in Kim's book as well. You've got them in here.
Yes, they're in my book. I also have some on my website at kellykimgardenandhome.com.
kellykimgardenandhome.com.
Yes. Garden and home.
Okay, I want to make sure I had that right.
Sure.
Nancy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jackie lives in northern Minnesota and has 7 raised garden beds made out of railroad ties. They're perfect because I can sit on them and reach halfway across and weed or pick produce. I know that she has to plant 8 to 10 inches from the edge because of the wood treatment. The two questions she has is how often do you fertilize, and how do you keep bees from nesting in the ties?
Oh, wow. Okay. I haven't had that that issue. As far as fertilizing goes, I really like to fertilize my vegetables in raised beds, I'd say every 3 to 4 weeks or so. And I use I actually put some granular fertilizer along with compost in the soil at the time of planting, because that's a slow release fertilizer. Use worm castings, organic fertilizer, and then the compost to kind of slowly release nutrients over the growing season. And then I will feed with a liquid fertilizer, which will be immediately released to the plants at planting time. And then about once a month or so, I'll fertilize again with that liquid fertilizer, because you really want to keep the plants fed and happy. It's kind of like us. If we don't eat, we get tired, we don't do as well. Same thing with the plants. Once they're producing, you want to really keep them going and happy through the growing season. And I do have a whole fertilizer schedule of how I prefer to fertilize in my book, too. So it lays it all out for you, so you don't have to wonder, like, oh, my goodness, when do I fertilize my plants and what do I use? It's all in there for you to keep your plants happy, healthy, and giving you lots of veggies.
Okay. And if you have a question, join in, 800-642-1234, the number to call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Lyric in Blanchardville, and she's calling in relation to the wood that you could use for raised beds. And she mentions that black locust has been recommended to her. It can last up to 90 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. I have not ever used black locust or done a lot of research on it. But, man, if that works for you, more power to you, I'd say go for it. You know, just do your research so you know exactly what you're planting and you know, so you're dissatisfied with that wood. And you always want to kind of stick to, you know, also evaluate what's your budget, because a lot of woods are a lot more expensive. So it could be, because it lasts so long, it's going to be a lot more costly. Whereas some of the woods like a Douglas fir or a pine are more cost-effective, won't last as long. But, you know, you kind of balance out the pros and cons and then see what works best for you.
Yeah. So, you know, we've talked about soil, but just sort of in general terms, probably the most important element to a raised bed.
Definitely.
So what do you normally suggest we would use?
Well, yeah, soil is probably one of the biggest investments you're going to make in your raised bed garden, but it's definitely one of the most important, because I've made the mistake in my early gardening years of using cheap soil or free soil that was advertised on, you know, Facebook Marketplace or what have you, and it honestly didn't work out well. So cheapest isn't always the best. You have a couple different options for soil. You can make your own, which to me is the most cost effective. There's lots of, you know, great ingredients you can put in your soil, but it's not always the most convenient. Or you can buy bagged soil, which is super convenient, but again, it's a lot more expensive. You can spend a lot of money on bagged raised bed soil. So I really like to make sure that the soil has a really good balance of aeration, lots of airflow through the soil so it doesn't get bogged down and, you know, turn into clay. You want it to have, on the other hand, moisture retention so your vegetables don't dry out. But at the same time, you need to have a good balance of nutrients. So a soil that has a good balance of all three of these elements will be great soil that's going to grow you tons of veggies. So in my book, I've got several DIY recipes. If you're starting out on a budget, I really recommend that if you've got some topsoil, which is like the top of the layer of soil in your backyard, you kind of dig up some of that and then mix it with some other ingredients that will give you a really quality nutrient soil. If you don't have topsoil in your garden, you can always purchase bagged topsoil, which is fairly inexpensive, and then combine it with ingredients like compost, worm castings, and to really bulk that soil up and give it that nutrient-dense quality that you need to plant your vegetables in.
Yeah. Well,
but again, lots of DIY recipes in my book. So depending on the ingredients that you have available to you, there's a recipe in there for you.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, when you're mixing, what do you do, like half and half? Or?
Well, I've got the recipes laid out in for the topsoil recipe. What you can do, too, is just make it right in your bed. You can, you know, dump it, or in a wheelbarrow, you can dump it in your bed, like say maybe about half full or so with topsoil, and then add another half full of compost. Put in some worm castings on the top, several bags of worm castings, mix it together, and then you're pretty much ready to plant after that. However, rather than filling the bed entirely up with soil, you can definitely save some money by filling up the bottom, I'd say maybe third or so, with, like, if you've cut some branches down in your yard, you can throw the branches in. If you've got some leaves that you've been saving, you can throw those in. So you're kind of bulking up the bed with some materials, so you don't have to use as much soil. And then what happens is, over time, those materials compost and break down. So you're also adding nutrients to your garden bed, and you're saving yourself on soil at the same time. Now, keep in mind that will cause your soil to settle. So the next planting year, growing season, you'll want to be topping that off with some fresh nutrients, which you'd want to do anyway to give your plants some good nutrients to grow in.
Let's go to Rick in Waukesha next. Hi, Rick. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a quick question. I have an old animal horse trough that's made out of aluminum that I'd like to use for a raised bed. Do I need to wash it out, clean it out with bleach and water, or soap and water? Do you need to take any precautions like that? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Thanks, Rick. I would definitely clean it out. Bleach, soap and water, whatever you have available that you get it nice and clean. And then you do want to make sure that you drill some holes in the bottom for drainage. Super important. If you don't have holes for drainage, your plants are going to rot. And there you go. You've got a raised bed and you didn't even have to spend any money on it. So way to go.
How many, you know, like hole, when we talk about holes, you know, dime size holes, and how many would you put like per square yard, let's say?
Sure. I would say, yeah, in a bed that size, you could do, you wouldn't necessarily have to do dime size holes. You could do like, you know, maybe quarter inch holes. I would probably drill them every probably 3 to 4 inches along the bottom of the raised bed. There's no like set recipe for that. Again, it's like experiment and do what works for you. And really, no matter what you do, as long as you're following some general guidelines and general principles, I know you and I live in totally different areas and climates, but as long as you're following the general principles of growing, you're going to be able to grow vegetables no matter where you live.
Rick, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Marty emailed to ask how close you plant your vegetable plants. Can you do it closer than what the seed packets say?
I say yes, you can. I like, especially in raised beds, because you're filling your raised beds with nutrient-dense soil. And the same thing goes for the fabric raised beds. Because of the aeration that the fabric raised beds provide, the plants don't get root-bound in those. They're still able to take up the nutrients, the water, in order to grow and be really strong and healthy for you. So, you know, there's so many different vegetables, so I can't really give, you know, just one set answer for that. But it really does depend on the vegetable that you're growing. Larger vegetables, such as tomatoes, I'm always pushing the envelope on that. A lot of people say 2 to 3 feet. I'll plant mine like, you know, a foot and a half or so apart. But try and, if you do plant them closer together, you do want to make sure that you are definitely fertilizing on a regular schedule, especially those vegetables that require, that are heavy feeders, what they're called. They're power producers. They produce a lot of vegetables. So you're going to have to make sure that you do keep that fertilizing schedule really regular. And actually, in the back of my book, I have a whole chart on intensive planting to help you figure out if you do want to plant closer together or plant intensively. It kind of gives a guideline on how close you can actually put different vegetables.
You tell a funny story. You tell a funny story in the back of your book about the first time that you with tomatoes.
Oh, yes. Yes, my very first year gardening at our house here, it was my first time gardening as an adult. You get your baby vegetable, your baby seedlings, and they're tiny. And you think, oh, I'm just going to put those about 6 inches apart. But, you know, you kind of forget that they grow. And you want your garden bed to look really nice when you plant it, but they grow and they're just, it was crazy. I had a tomato jungle. I had like a little rat family living in there. There were all kinds of things. But you know what? I learned from it. I got a ton of tomatoes that year, and it really was a lot of fun. It was a fun story to tell too.
It had to be. Callie Kim, our guest today, as we're talking raised beds and vegetables with her. Kim is an organic gardener, and her book is Raised Bed Gardening, all the know-how you need to build and grow a raised bed garden. Questions for her about raised beds or about vegetables? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Callie Kim, an organic urban organic gardener, and her book is titled Raised Bed Gardening, All the Know-How You Need to Build and Grow a Raised Bed Garden. So we're talking with her about those raised beds. And, of course, vegetables. You can take your vegetable questions as well at 800-642-1234. And let's take another call. Kathy in northern Wisconsin, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Been listening to your show for a very long time. Got a lot of good information. And the raised beds, I do. I've got the bags. But also a question, I do the hay bale. Wondering if you could break down your hay bale to start your raised garden.
Kathy, I prefer not to use hay in my garden bed because hay has a lot of weed seeds. So it's not my favorite way to do that. I know it's a very popular to grow in straw bales, which is different than hay. It doesn't have the weed seeds. So if you have that option to get straw bales rather than hay, I would definitely recommend that. There's also lots of great shredded straw type products on the market, but straw bales are very inexpensive. And that would be a good thing to kind of lay down on the bottom of your raised bed. I wouldn't necessarily fill it, like a third full, like I mentioned, with the leaves and twigs and branches and things like that, because it will tend to get compacted. But you could use a layer of on the bottom, but then definitely layer it with some other materials to give it some aeration. And straw is a really good thing also to mulch the top of your raised beds with. It works better if you can kind of shred it up somehow, like with your lawnmower or with a weed whacker, in a trash can, wearing safety glasses, of course, to protect your eyes. But it's great to use for mulch to really help retain the water or to help your vegetables stay warmer if you're planting them or growing them during the cooler months.
There you go, Kathy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, on to you now. Hi, Stella.
Hi. I just caught, there are two things I'd like to mention. Just very briefly, we have a kumquat tree in our greenhouse, and it is currently producing a huge crop of kumquats. And the one thing I'd like to mention about that is if you're growing a kumquat tree, let them get really ripe because then they're very sweet and delicious. And the main thing that I called in about is I would like to describe the raised beds that we made. And we discovered just by chance, we were building along our lot line, and our neighbor had planted a cedar hedge along the lot line, and we did not want the cedar roots to grow into the raised beds. And so what we did was we're working on a large scale, 2 feet, 4 feet wide by 2 feet high, and the first two beds were 40 feet long.
And, wow.
And what we did was we lined them with a heavy-duty pond liner, completely lined the boxes. So that way we were able to use treated, for one thing, we were able to use treated lumber because it never comes into contact with the soil. And inadvertently, and we filled about two-thirds full with washed river sand, and then the top third with a mixture of topsoil and compost. And there is a drainage and an emergency overflow hole at each end of the box. One hole, it's about 6 inches up from the bottom, and it's maybe about quarter sized or so. And it turns out we found out because of the pond liner and the sand that we have built gigantic self-watering growing beds.
Oh.
Interesting. Wow. It was kind of a discovery by accident, but you experimented with something, and it turned out great, and I'm sure you're probably making adjustments as you go, but that's the beauty of there's no one way to garden. There's different growing conditions, different materials available to you, and you absolutely made the best out of it, and it turned out wonderful. Those beds sound beautiful.
Yeah, Stella, thank you so much. Water does come to mind, and there are, with smaller raised beds or under different conditions, you're going to maybe need more water or regular watering. perhaps more so than if you were just relying on rain.
Absolutely. If you live in an area where you get lots of rain, you're very fortunate. But most of us, well, especially, you know, Southern California, we don't always have that luxury. So for me personally, and I recommend this to a lot of people, even if you do live in a more, you know, wetter or more humid climate, is to install drip irrigation. Now, a lot of people get a little bit intimidated when they hear that, but really consistent watering is the key to growing vegetables. If you're going to take the time to really, you know, build your raised beds, plant your vegetables, you want to put food on your table for your family, I highly recommend it. It's not near as bad as a lot of people think. There's so many easy kits and things out there on the market to really help you get started that have all the different parts included. And I've got detailed instructions, detailed videos on our YouTube channel, actually detailed instructions in my first book called Organic Gardening for Everyone. But that's just a little series of hoses that you wind throughout your garden bed. You can hook it up to, if you've got a sprinkler system or even just a hose bib, and set it on a timer. So you just set it and forget it. And then you can kind of adjust the time or the frequency of watering according to the season. Mine is pretty much turned off right now because we have had so much rain. But in the summertime, in the heat of the summer, you can adjust the frequency that you water, and you can even go on vacation, and you don't have to worry about watering your garden bed. Just being a busy person and, you know, working full-time, having kids, you just don't always get out there to water your garden. So drip irrigation is a great way to just set it and forget it and to guarantee that your vegetables will get the water they need to be productive. So it saves my garden, and I know a lot of people are really enjoying the benefits of drip irrigation too.
Well, the other advantage is that then the water is coming in from below and not spraying the leaves of the plants, so your likelihood Absolutely. Of disease is lessened.
Definitely. Yeah, that's definitely something to consider, to try and get your water at the roots of your plants when you can, and that's definitely a huge benefit of drip. Besides being a water saver, it gets the water right to where your plants need it the most, sinks down into the roots, rather than watering the leaves, which can cause diseases, bring the pests in, you know, just harbor like powdery mildew and different diseases that might attack your garden. So lots of benefits to that.
Perry in Reedstown, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Perry. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about raised beds. What do you suggest to put around the raised bed as a way of keeping the weeds down if it's in a already prepared soil? You know, if the soil that you're putting the raised beds in has already been tilled in the past, what
okay.
do you put down between the raised beds?
In between the raised beds, okay. What I would do is in between the raised beds, if you're making your, like you're referring to like a pathway in between that you could access the raised beds from, correct?
Yeah.
No, okay.
The right period. Okay. Great. What I would do is I would lay down some cardboard to kind of smother those weeds out.
Okay.
And then
cardboard.
And then I would put something down on top of that cardboard to make it more aesthetically pleasing. You're going to be walking in your around your raised bed. You're going to be enjoying your garden. So I would put down, I prefer to use like a cedar wood chip in my pathways. Those are actually very inexpensive to buy bagged. At your local garden center, or you can buy them in bulk from a landscape company in your area. You know, if that doesn't work for you, you could also use like river rock or something like that just to line those pathways with to keep the weeds down. And your garden is going to be someplace that you're going to be sitting and enjoying yourself and working out there. So you definitely want it to be something that's very aesthetically pleasing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Perry, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, let's turn to Al in Manitowoc next. Hi, Al.
Good morning, Larry. So I have two questions. One is, how do you recommend protecting climbing plants like tomatoes from when they're ripening from being attacked by squirrels or chipmunks? And number two is, can I use used potting soil from plants as kind of the base in a raised bed, and then put the regular mixture of actual growing soil on top of that?
Okay, great. Squirrels, yeah, are definitely always a big problem in the garden. And actually, referred to this question a little bit earlier, is some of my special plants I will wrap in like a tulle or a netting to kind of keep the squirrels away. But you can also make a DIY like hot pepper spray. They don't like the smell of that. It will irritate them and they'll hopefully leave. Not a guarantee, but hopefully with those two deterrents, you can kind of keep things at bay there for the squirrels and chipmunks. And your second question referring to using potting mix, absolutely. Your soil is your biggest investment, whether you're growing in containers, in raised beds, or in your in-ground garden, you never want to throw it away. I reuse my soil over and over. But the key is to really refresh that, and just like you're doing, adding fresh nutrients every time you plant. But that used potting soil is a great base for your raised bed soil mix for sure.
Yeah. Al, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Chuck emailed to ask the kind of protection from the bottom side of raised bed to protect from burrowing animals. And we talked a little about this, but it probably bears repeating.
Sure, yeah. You know, a lot of people will lay down. We don't have a big issue with like groundhogs or things like that. But a lot of people will lay down that it's called hardware fabric. It's actually like a mesh type of wire fencing with small, tiny holes. We'll lay that down in the bottom of the raised beds to help prevent the groundhogs from digging up and pulling out your vegetables from the bottom. Because that's very disconcerting. I've had friends actually see that happen, and that's crazy. So that will really help go a long way towards deterring those pesky creatures.
Yeah, it looks like something, if you actually see it, it looks like something out of a cartoon, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Pretty disconcerting when you work so hard to get those vegetables to grow and they're gone.
Arlen emailed to ask if AC2 treated lumber, so A, capital C, number 2, treated lumber is okay for raised beds.
I'm not familiar with that particular type of lumber, and I don't typically use treated lumber, but I definitely recommend doing your research. From what I have researched, the lumber that is treated these days is a lot safer than, you know, back 20 or 30 years ago. But do your research if that's a concern for you, and use whatever you're comfortable with.
And a listener emailed to ask if you approved of using decaying fall leaves as mulch in a raised garden bed. If so, what are the benefits?
Absolutely. In fact, leaves are one of my favorite free resources to use in the garden. Whether you're composting them, breaking them down into free fertilizer for your garden beds, or what I typically do is I've got a pile of leaves and I'll dig from the bottom of that when I'm actually filling my raised beds, because that's where it's broken down the most, is on the bottom, and mix that into my soil. The benefits of leaves are so many. Number one, they add, you know, organic matter to your soil, they add aeration to your soil. They're kind of like nature's gift to us. So when you look out in the forest, the leaves fall, things grow underneath the trees, and we're kind of just mimicking nature by using leaves in our garden. So you can mix them into your soil. You can also use them as a mulch on top of your soil, which is one of my favorite things to do with them. Even throughout the winter time, when the wind is blowing really hard, you know, just kind of helps prevent erosion. And even in the summertime when it's hot, it will help the moisture retention of your soil tremendously if you mulch with shredded leaves or any type of mulch, really. But shredded leaves, since they're free, are a great natural resource for us to use. I think, though, one of the biggest benefits that I love about leaves is that the worms absolutely love them. So if you add leaves to your garden, if you've got, you know, some heavy compacted soil, you mix leaves in, pretty soon you're going to see those worms come in. When the worms are eating the leaves, they're also depositing their waste, which is called worm castings, which is one of the best natural organic fertilizers that you can possibly have. And worms aerate the soil. There's just so many benefits of having worms in your garden. So anything you can do to bring in the worms is a huge, huge benefit to your garden soil.
Yes, know many people who actually in their neighborhoods will go around in the fall when the leaves, everybody puts their leaves out by the street. They go around and pick up the neighbor's leaves and drag them over to their own house.
Absolutely. It's a free resource, so why not take advantage of it? A lot of people don't garden, or maybe they don't want their leaves. So great way to make use of your free natural resources.
And then run a lawnmower over them or something.
Absolutely.
to get them shredded. Callie Kim is our guest today, an organic gardener. Her latest book is Raised Bed Gardening, All the Know-How You Need to Build and Grow a Raised Bed Garden. Callie Kim, Garden and Home DIY. Talking with us on Garden Talk today, I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we talk about ways to lengthen your growing season. With us from Minnesota, Meg McAndrews-Cowden, author of the book Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat. It's a dandy book. I really like it, and I think you're going to love hearing about it. And, of course, she'll talk about it and answer your questions as well as we move along here today. She is a self-taught gardener, organic gardener, with an advanced degree in natural resource management. And you can follow her on Instagram at seed2fork. So as we talk with Meg, I hope you'll join in. What would you like to know about succession planting? What's going on in your garden right now that you have questions about? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Meg McAndrews-Cowden, welcome to the show. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Larry. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and really? Chat gardening.
Well, I tell you what, I really like your book.
Oh, thanks. I put a lot of love into that thing and a lot of years of experience.
Yeah, it's, and you know, it's the concept is succession gardening. And for those who aren't familiar with it, maybe just define what is succession gardening.
Sure. Well, I mean, the shortest possible way I would say succession gardening is really making sure that your garden is as productive for as long as possible. And we do that by lots of different methods. But it's really about this idea that the garden is dynamic. Landscapes are dynamic, as we know. We know here in the north that we've got four seasons and they are distinct. And so I think of our garden season, even though it's only maybe one or maybe two of those seasons, it's summer. For me, it's spring, summer, and fall. But it's got seasons within those seasons. And so succession planting is kind of celebrating and paying attention to these nuances and these seasons that we can have. And it's not only vegetables. It's not only thinking about, like, how can I stretch out my tomato harvest? For me, it's also about how can I stretch out my flowers? How can I ensure that pollinators, natives, and honeybees, everyone who's welcome here in my garden, which is all insects, unfortunately, because there's pests too here. But the idea is I want to make sure I have flowers as early as possible until as late as possible. Our apricot tree was the first thing to bloom this year. You know, we had a very early spring here in Minnesota. It's the first year it really bloomed in earnest. We had a few flowers in the past, but this year it profusely bloomed, and we maybe have about a dozen fruits, which is a first for us as gardeners. We've never eaten a homegrown apricot, so we're delighted. But it was covered in pollinators. The morning cloaks, native bees, the mason bees. This was early mid-April. So this succession planting is really about filling in every possible day, month, week of the gardening season with something for our wildlife to eat and something for us as well.
I looked at, I was thinking about it, and the way that you constantly have material there, food for your family to eat from really early to really late. And I thought, oh my goodness me, how... You would have a ton of food more than I would have in my garden, the way I've been planning it.
Okay, possibly. So one thing might be space. Our garden is kind of large. Maybe we should.
Yeah, tell me about your garden.
And there's lots of images in the book as well as on social media. So we left the city in 2016 to move out to land, and our garden is slightly larger than our Minneapolis entire lot was from curb to alley. Our house, our old house, our garage, the boulevard, the sidewalk, those could all fit inside our current garden. So for those of you who live in an urban, it's maybe 8,000 square feet that's fenced in. It's about between an eighth and a quarter of an acre. It's not quite a quarter acre, but that also includes our kind of bucolic red barn. We've got two patios within there. And this whole space was very intentionally fenced off before we planted anything. We put a deer fence that was also rabbit proof when we built the garden. They were initially raised or in-ground beds, and we transitioned to raised beds three seasons ago. So everything's raised beds now, and we have, I should know these numbers, Larry, but I knew last year, maybe 5,000 square feet in actual vegetable raised beds. Maybe it's more like 2,500. Maybe it's a total of like 5,000 square feet total. It's a lot. It's a lot. It's very intensively planted. And we grow more than we need or can consume. And the joy of that is being able to give food to neighbors and friends. And when we go places, doctor's appointments or haircuts or music lessons, I bring little mini CSAs to people. And that's kind of the joy of it too, is sharing it. And you know, being inspired, like, oh, wow, you have broccoli already. Well, of course I have broccoli in early June. This is how I garden, you know?
Well, I loved it. I wondered if you were into canning or food preservation in any way at all.
Absolutely. If you garden on this scale and you don't can, you're crazy. I mean, yes, I do. I grow all of our own tomatoes. We haven't bought a store-bought can of tomatoes in several years. It took me a few years to figure out how many tomato plants I need. I make ketchup. That's probably one of my favorite things to do with tomatoes, but it really takes a lot of reduction to get, you know, it's probably 100 pounds of tomatoes go into my, you know, couple of pounds of ketchup. So, but these are the joys of gardening, is that we can choose how we want to spend our time, right, with our food. And yeah, canning is for sure a big part of it for us.
And your background in natural resources, I think, kind of comes through in the writing. You talk about the relation, you know, learning from the forest land, for mm-hmm. example.
I didn't realize how much influence that had on me. And it was really this one very poignant moment. I was out east. I was born and raised in Southern Connecticut, and I was out visiting my parents, and I was walking by these woods. I can remember exactly where I was, and I saw sort of the edge that was on the south side of the road, and there were shrubs there. And it was the time when I was thinking about what kind of concept of a book I wanted to write about. And after doing research, I knew no one had written about succession planting. And I was like, okay, well, what about succession planting, right? Is this a whole book? And then I realized, like, every landscape that I love has some aspect that we apply to gardening, whether we know it or not. And that whole idea of the edge, and you think about the edges and, you know, how much can we shove underneath our tomato plants or near our tomato plants? Or if you've got vining crops, can you grow in the shade things like celery or cilantro or lettuce and things like that? And then the prairie too, which it took me a while to learn to love it, because I really am still very much enamored with the Pacific Northwest and the majestic forests out there and the rainforests. Yeah. That whole landscape has been, it was just a really big part of my formative years, and it's still, I love it. But prairies, I learned to love them as much, which is saying a lot. It took me about 10 years being here. I've been here 21 years. About half the time I tried to love it, and now I really understand it and love it. And prairies are probably one of the most relatable things for people, I think, in the Midwest, in terms of what they offer. They yeah. offer something to pollinators all season long. And if as gardeners, we can think like, wow, I got my golden Alexanders in May and my penstemon in June and my, you know, pale purple coneflower in early July. What could that look like as vegetables, right? So, and paying attention to what landscapes you love and why you love them and why you love the seasons of them kind of could help all of us grow, I think, as better gardeners and better tenders of whatever bits yeah. of land we are lucky to garden. Yeah.
Most of the gardens you see, I mean, there's a row of radishes, then there might be a row of onions, then there might be a row of something else. And you have some rows, I guess, but you're not going to, in many your philosophy is not necessarily we're going to plant all the same thing. You plant a bunch of things together. Let's put it that way.
Yes, and I do have, and yes, sometimes I interplant, and I do interplant a lot. And I think that's what you're referring to, is yeah. It's not just, I never just plant tomatoes. I'll do my, under my indeterminate tomatoes that I trellis right now, for instance, I've got some celery under there. I've got some head lettuce under there. I've got some marigolds this year instead of sweet alyssum. Next to my determinate tomatoes, I've got cilantro on the north and basil on the south because they're still very small. I'm playing with direct seeding, Larry, so I direct seed my determinate tomatoes now, and they're only about 6 inches tall, but I did this last year, and it worked, and I'm not getting any younger, so I'm trying to find ways to garden easier, and direct seeding is like my new little pet project of trying to see what I don't have to sow indoors.
Yeah.
But yes, there are some things that don't interplant well. You know, I don't really interplant my garlic. I keep that well tended. And onions too. Things, if you think about it, the easiest way to think about it, things that vine and grow tall, you can get away with planting something underneath because the plant, as long as it's low growing, because it's not going to compete for sunlight. But things that are shorter and stay shorter, like your onions and your garlic, my peanuts that I grow every year, things like, I don't even really interplant my peppers very much. I'll put flowers kind of at the ends of the beds, but things that stay a little shorter, they're going to struggle if you plant something with it. One of the worst examples was, tomatillos, which, you know, I know that they are ridiculously crazy. I planted a couple many years ago, and then I planted some nasturtium with them that I thought were mounding. Mm-hmm. And I think I referenced this in my book, and, they were not mounding, they were vining. And by the middle of August, it looked like a nasturtium hedge. And it was really hard to tell what the dominant plant was supposed to be because the nasturtium completely took over. So you have to be very careful with how you pair things together. Yeah. You know, but it is fun. I mean, why not? I love having the color in my garden. I love having the insects with me. I love having the monarchs and the swallowtails and the goldfinches come in. And I just love the visiting my garden as a visitor alongside insects, if that makes sense. That's just a real important part of my gardening philosophy.
Well, I do like your writing. You have a wonderful writing style and the wonderful photos and absolutely wonderful illustrations in the book. But maybe just before we go any further, just to lay out how plant, grow, harvest, repeat, what we have in your book.
Yeah, so this book starts at the landscape level, and I introduce the idea of succession planting in the first chapter, and I give these parallels, as we talked about a few minutes earlier, to prairies and forests and kind of how the season works, and really try to set the reader up for imagining a garden as as something that is constantly in flux. That's how I see succession planting, is you have to be okay with reaching for seeds any day. As I say somewhere in the book, I say, you know, succession gardening is the opposite of a plant it one day garden. It really is. And I have gaps in my garden still. We are June 14th. I have a couple of pockets in my garden that I haven't planted yet. And it's kind of by design because I like to stagger things out. And so in the book, I frame succession planting in several ways. I talk about different ways that you can do it, whether blocking was what I just kind of talked about with the garlic and the onions, things that you want to kind of contain together. I talk about staggering your succession. So the easiest example and relatable would be planting paste tomatoes and cherry tomatoes and beefsteaks. Those are all going to kind of come into season at various times. So they will be staggered across time. So you're looking at that's a kind of a temporal way. And then you've got continuous planting, which is kind of what I'm doing right now. I set up some soil blocks this morning. I'm going to be sowing some beets and fennel and cabbage and cauliflower for fall once I get off air here. So and then I also talk about season extending. And that's a really important part for us in northern climates, which is that we can gain weeks, pretty much a couple of months to our growing season if we really consider putting up just little hoops in our garden. And then the rest of the book really talks about applying that. So I go into perennial edibles and talk about kind of how they are a succession. You know, strawberries mature very quickly, but pears are kind of the old growth, or hazelnuts are even more old growth of edibles. And I talk about native edibles as well as cultivated. I go into vegetables and I talk about different vegetables, and I talk about how they are in succession. And so I talk about the season as early, kind of mid and late. And that's really, again, time. It's how much time vegetables are taking to mature. So the early ones are things like cilantro and arugula and spinach and radishes, kind of garden fast food, if you will. And then you get into kind of 1 to 2 month time frame. Then you get into 3 month, and then you get way like 4 to 5, or maybe even longer in the case of, say, garlic, which we all, some of us, I shouldn't say we all know, takes, you know, about 10 months to mature. And then I talk about interplanting. And then throughout the book, I also have kind of charts and diagrams to break out what you could sow when by season to help gardeners explore the idea of getting the most out of their garden.
Meg McAndrews Cowden, our guest today. Meg McAndrews Cowden is author of the book Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat. Questions for her as we move along today. Maybe you've got a garden question, maybe a general garden question. Maybe you have a question about succession gardening, or maybe you're doing it already. I'd love to hear what you've, what experiences you're having with it. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mailer for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Glad to have you with us for Garden Talk. Larry Mailer here with my guest, Meg McAndrews Cowden. Her book is titled Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat. And questions for her, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take some calls. Sherry and Trigo, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi.
Get you right on here, Sherry. What do you have for us?
Right. I love hearing what I'm hearing about this gal writing this book and her love of gardening and getting the most out of your garden. And I do similar things. And I believe in that intensive gardening approach where you don't just put one plant in one bed, but others that they grow like companion planting. But I'm wondering, I'm in growing zone 3. So I'm wondering about the book. I'm thinking about buying it, but I'm wondering if she considers a really short growing season. I mean, we have about June, July, August, September, about 4 months of good, you know, quality summer kind of weather. But so that's my question. Does
sure.
the book address, you know,
address those growing zones? Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. That's, thanks for the call. And that's a really great question. Yes. So all of my growing charts, all of my sowing charts, instead of saying when I sow them, I intentionally set it with how many weeks before my last frost so people could adjust accordingly. I would say the trick is less in the spring for a zone 3, and it might be more in the fall because you're even a little more punctuated on the fall end. So, you know, if I'm trying to grow storage cabbages for the fall, I would start those, let's say, in the third week of May. You might have to start those before your last frost then, but I will say that this book has been purchased and applied and adored tons of people in Canada and Manitoba and farther north use it. A very good friend in Charleston, South Carolina uses it and raves about my sowing charts. So I tried to make this not just a northern book for northern zones, although I will say that I hear from a lot of people that appreciate following me because so many gardening accounts online are from warmer climates. But yes, I think there's plenty here. And I really tried to make, you know, all the perennials to be zone three Hardia when I could. So even on like a lot of the edible perennials I talk about and things like that. So I would say there's plenty of information in there that would be really useful for you and your garden.
So in a zone three, now, Sherry, when did you say that you start? I mean, what's your growing season for you? I mean,
well, I also have, I'm 60 years old, and I related when she says I don't have many years left. I count my summers and I think, okay, but it's funny, you know, oh, God holds, you know, our lives in his hands. But I start a lot of seeds indoors, you know, and I haven't gotten broccoli in to where it where I can harvest in the spring yet. But I am trying to focus more on a fall harvest, like she was saying. So a fall harvest. And I'm actually going to direct sow, which I've never done direct sowing broccoli, but I'm going to try doing that like now to see, you know, what's going to come of it in the fall. Because broccoli doesn't like it. A lot of times it will bolt when it's too hot.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Can I chime in here? Okay, Sherry, you got a couple things going on that I want to talk about. So I'm all for this direct seeding broccoli. I think it's great. I have direct seeded brassicas in the summer and they've worked out well. If things are bolting, I might play with other varieties. A lot of the broccoli I grow, I almost grow strictly heat tolerant broccoli, because just because it's a heat tolerant variety doesn't mean it won't do well when it's cooler too, if that makes sense. So a variety like Bellstar, it's a hybrid, but it's kind of a tried and true. I can get it sometimes to produce side shoots into August. I'm just cutting my first heads now. Those were sowed indoors in the end of February. They were transplanted on April 9th when my soil temperatures were about 50 degrees under a low tunnel. I think you could totally do a spring broccoli if you wanted. It would take a little bit of season extending and putting up a low tunnel, which, if that's too much work for you, I completely respect that, because I get that we all have different seasons of kind of our gardening careers. But I would be so curious to hear how the broccoli direct seeding goes. I've done it for the spring and with cabbages and kohlrabi and bok choy and things like that, and it's been great. So
and you might mention your site again for somebody like Sherry might want to let you know.
Sure. So you can follow me online at Seed to Fork on Instagram, and my website is the same name, seedtofork.com.
Sherry, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And you mentioned, what did you say, trench or?
So it might have been a cold frame or a low tunnel, Larry.
Low tunnel.
Low tunnel.
What's a low tunnel?
So a low tunnel, I use just 10-foot electric metal conduits, or you can use PVC pipes, and I just bend them into a hoop. It's like a mini greenhouse. It gives you about 4 feet of height in your bed. You can drop them just directly into the ground if you have in-ground beds, and use rebar, put rebar into the ground and bend those pipes right over to those, and the rebar is kind of sleeves in. And then I use either 6 mil painter's poly, or if you want to go the extra mile, you buy some greenhouse poly, which lasts a little longer and is a little it's more translucent, more transparent. And then you use different kinds of clips to fashion that down, and that I put that up in the middle of February, and my soil temperatures inside there by early March are usually warm enough to plant, and I'll start direct seeding in there by the second week in March.
You've got a great actually have a great photo in there with snow on them.
Yeah. Often I'll have to shovel out to get the poly on. And I consider snow shoveling at the beginning of my gardening season in a way, you know, shoveling snow in the garden.
Oh, man. Sherry, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Heather in Brooklyn will go to you next. Brooklyn, Wisconsin. Hi, Heather.
Larry and Meg, hello to you both. I consider both of you some of my garden mentors, so it's very nice to talk to you today.
Well, thank you.
Hi, Heather. I know Heather.
yes. So I'm a little bit south of Madison, and I just wanted to kind of expand on what I can do with an extra zone warmer than Meg. And over the past couple of years, I have been experimenting with cold frame growing. So I definitely took a lot of inspiration from Meg, but the digging out the cold frames in February wasn't so appealing to me. So I put polycarbonate frames over the top of my garden beds that are already in the ground. And I plant pretty much an entire bed of very cold tolerant lettuces and spinach and herbs and alliums in about August and September. And that allows us to be harvesting salad greens all the way through the winter, just south of Madison. And I don't think people really realize that we are capable of year-round growing in our area.
So you do it year-round, Heather. Wow.
Yeah. I think we really push ourselves because I really want salad greens in the winter, and I really don't like buying them. So.
Oh, thank you so much for calling. I love that. And if Heather can do it.
Exactly. Yeah, Heather's a great example. She shares a lot of her her trials with me and her successes. And yes, I think she makes a great point that she's motivated and curious. And I will say, unlike Sherry and maybe myself, she is on the younger side. So she has energy in some ways to really push her season. But I think we all need to be curious with the changing climate of what is realistic for us. And one thing I do, Heather covers it, I plant spinach on the fall equinox. This is like, if someone thinks I'm crazy and this is too much gardening, Larry, this is like one of the easier things to do is I plant spinach on the fall equinox here. I'm in zone 4. Maybe if you're in zone 3, maybe you want to plant it on September 1st. I maybe get a harvest. I get true leaves. I get a couple of sets of true leaves before the hard freeze. I don't touch it. I don't cover it. Like we had mentioned, she covers hers. I just let it sit in the garden. I forget about it. Usually the snow covers it. This year it didn't for very long, so I was a little worried about it. But I am harvesting spinach in March and April, and I planted it in the fall. And it's super easy because the garden's empty. So if you love spinach, go for it. Fill a whole bed with it. It's going to bolt sometime in May, which is going to be just in time to drop your tomatoes or your peppers, your potatoes or corn in there. So it's a really nice way of stretching out the season and sort of a lazy way to do it. I think it's great.
And you have another ritual that I really liked a lot, and that involves the first day of spring.
Yep. I always plant seeds on the first day of spring. And it has changed over the years. It was the equinox radish for a while there that I would usually harvest by the end of April. And these, again, are under this low tunnel. So this tunnel that I end up stuffing with a lot of brassicas, there's always room. You know, my brassicas are pretty small, so I've got 18 inches or more between those rows of brassicas. That's soil. And so that's where I put those 30-day to 40-day crops in there that are going to come out before the cabbages and broccoli get too big. So, yeah, I really like marking time like that, and it makes it sort of fun and almost easier in a way to get behind. If you're someone who maybe procrastinates, which I know it's hard to believe, but I am quite a procrastinator, so these rituals help me stay on track.
Questions for Meg, maybe. What's going on in your garden right now? Or maybe you have a question about succession gardening. I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Let's talk about, you know, kind of the step approach here a little bit. In order to have a successful succession garden, the first step is to plant well, you say.
Yeah.
How do you start that plan?
Well, I think the best planned garden is making sure you're growing food that you really want to eat.
Yeah.
And that, you know, is going to be grow well for your zone. So there were a few years there where I kind of lost my way and was swayed by the online images of colorful vegetables and, you know, the alluring marketing of seed catalogs. But I've gotten a little stronger willed and a little clearer, right, in terms of, okay, I don't know. Right now, I am on a spice kick, and I wanna grow my own mustard seed for my own pickles. So I've set aside space to grow Dijon mustard seeds this year. So I think that's part of it. And I think this. So, like for example, I know people who grow like a half a dozen summer squash, and I think they're absolutely bananas. I mean, I grow one or two summer squash plants, and even with that, I end up pulling one of them out by the middle of August and replanting it with root crops or something for the fall. So, and you got to be really careful about your space too. So I think one of the biggest things that people, where people go wrong, especially young gardeners, is they try to put too much in. If your plant is little, you think you should put it close to the next little plant you're planting it with. Whereas you have to really think about maturity and how large plants are going to get. My plants get very large because we have really great sun aspect, long, like 12 hours of sun in the height of summer in our garden. And there's no trees, so there's no tree roots creeping in. And so plants just flourish. And thank goodness for the rain. Are you guys getting rain in Wisconsin this spring?
Oh,
we are getting
yes.
rain like every other day.
Yes, we are.
I mean, I tell myself I'm never complaining about rain again after those three dry years, but maybe in a few years, if it's still raining this much, I will. But yeah. And then, you know, the other thing about that garden plan and for succession planting is try to plant something that's going to create a gap. So I think garlic or that spinach that I mentioned, like planting something in the fall that will create a gap sometime in the growing season, that's a great entry point for succession planting. I gave a talk out in Western Minnesota a few years ago, and I was talking about getting your fall garden going. I was talking in the end of July, and I asked people, you know, what do you guys do when your peas are done? And they're like, we just leave them. And I just about fell over. I was like, there's so much opportunity. So, and you know, even locally, I'll see people who do, you know, their row of cabbages, their row of tomatoes, you know, it's kind of the garden's kind of even further out. We're kind of on the edge of country out here in the West Metro of Minneapolis. And I'm thinking, wow, they could replant that. So think about replanting things. I also love to rip out my cucumbers, my pickling cucumbers. Once I've got my, you know, 12 to 20 quarts of pickles for the year, I'm sorry, I don't need to harvest any more pickles. I don't need to give them away. So I pull it all out and I plant that with either kohlrabi, Napa cabbage, watermelon radish, quick lettuces, something 50 days or quicker to maturity. So it's this constant playing of like how many weeks before my last frost or my first frost in that case in the fall. I'm constantly assessing, right? Like what seeds can I play with?
And you have a description of the different kinds of successions and what kinds of vegetables, and maybe talk a bit about that. That there are different types of succession, different kinds of vegetables you can grow during each type.
Right, right. So you've got your fast maturing, your early succession plants, which I consider sort of 40 days or less. And those are a lot of your leafy greens and radishes, mostly, and some quick herbs like cilantro. And then you've got your sort of mid-season succession. So those things take about 2 months to mature. And then you've got, so those are kind of a lot of like our, I mean, they take 2 months to mature, but I also consider some of those you need to start indoors. So like, you know, your tomatoes are 70 days to mature, but you've also need a couple of months, that lead up time. Same with peppers and eggplants. Things like beets would be in that section too, as well as brassicas. Corn as well, a lot of things, beans. I think of that as kind of our main kind of what a traditional garden would be.
Sure.
Right. Two to three months. And then you've got your late season or kind of your long season succession. And those are how I phrase them. So leeks, garlic, onions, Brussels sprouts, things that are taking 4 or more months. And those things, oh, and also winter squash, also dry corn, popcorn, dry beans are faster, but things that the space won't turn over in the garden, right? So I kind of think of those as my architectural pieces for the garden, the growing season. So wherever I stake space for those, I'm not going to succession plant in those places, right? Like, I'm not going to be harvesting my summer squash in late September and planting something there. I could plant spinach, I guess, but I don't usually. But the spaces where we can succession plant are that early season and a lot of those mid-season successions. So I love to plant more than one succession of snap beans, bush beans. When your peas come out, that's a great place to succession plant behind it. And there's another category I have is generalist successions. And these really are a northern climate variety, yeah. Right? This is where my book speaks to the northern climate, because I have a friend down in North Carolina who, when she saw my garden a couple of years ago, could not believe how beautiful my brassicas were. And she had total brassica envy. And so to all your listeners who, like, you know, feel like we don't have it good up here, we are built to grow brassicas. You know, they're endemic to, you know, Northern Europe, which is even further north than we are latitude wise. So we can all just celebrate the brassica, but not the cabbage white butterfly. So brassicas, carrots and beets are what I call kind of generalist successions, in that I can grow them in the spring, I can grow them in the summer, and I can grow them in the fall. They're cold tolerant and they're heat tolerant, they're frost hardy. And those are kind of your pocket succession planting friends, I would say. If you don't like beets, whatever, don't grow them. But carrots, who doesn't love a garden carrot? So those are the things that I reach for most often when I'm getting ready to succession plant, to keep that in production.
And if you don't like beets, you should try grilling them.
pickling them. I do love a pickled beet.
Oh, I do too. Our guest today, Meg McAndrews Cowden. Her book is called Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat. Great to have her with us. And you can join in too. The number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Great to have you along for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Meg McAndrews Cowden, and her book is titled Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat. She also has Instagram and a website, and just go to Seed to Fork for that. Seed to Fork is where you need to go to get to her Instagram and to her website, which she's got lots of good information there. Questions, join in, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Let's talk a little bit more about interplanting. Yeah, what are some do's and don'ts? Maybe talk a little more about some of the do's and don'ts connected with that.
Yeah, that's a great question. You got to make sure, I like to think, and this gets back to that first chapter in the book where I talk about landscapes, Larry, every space in our garden has an overstory and potentially an understory if we're interplanting it. And an overstory is sort of, think of that as the highest point in any bed in your garden. It would be the tallest trees on your property. If you're lucky enough to have trees, if you have a piece of land that has trees on it, that's your overstory. Your understory is what grows kind of in the shade or what grows below it. So I think of kind of our gardens as almost mini forests, right? So my tomatoes are my overstory. And if I can get something underneath them, that's my understory. And so you want to make sure you're pairing different heights together. I don't take it as far as companion planting, and I'm not looking for plants that maybe aren't using the same, pulling the same nutrients out of the soil. I don't go that far. I really look more for aesthetics when I interplant, so I do a lot of flower interplanting. But not all flowers can be interplanted. So flowers are probably the biggest thing I interplant with. I do greens. I do cilantro as vegetables, radishes in the early season. I'll sometimes run beets, interplant beets. It can be dicey. I've tried to put beets next to squash, and 2 weeks later, the squash has shaded out the beets, things like that. So even I can falter at this interplanting when it's vegetables and vegetables. But when it's vegetables and flowers, you almost can't go wrong as long as you're choosing low growing. So I love Tiny Tim is like kind of an extra small sweet alyssum. I think alyssum is a fantastic addition to any garden. Our garden is covered with hoverflies from May all the way through the end of the year. And hoverflies are voracious predators, you know, in their larval stages. It's completely invisible to my eye, but I know that I've got a large population of them, and it's great. I love nasturtium to interplant too, but that's kind of a little bigger. I also love gem marigolds. Those also can get a little on the tall side, so that's why I put them this year under my tomatoes, because I prune my tomatoes up, you know, a good 12 to 18 inches to prevent some splashing. And in these cases, so in the case of maybe interplanting flowers under your tomatoes, it's also acting as a living mulch. So it can keep the soil a little cooler, keep some weeds at bay, and then also hopefully prevent splashing, which is where so many soil-borne fungi can jump up onto the stems of our plants. So it's better than mulch, in my opinion, because it's beautiful and it brings in more insects. So I do talk about things. Zinnia, I don't really interplant. I'll interplant them with other flowers. I'll interplant them with ornamentals like I grow artichokes in our garden. This is my second year growing them. I like to interplant them with kale and things like that, things that I tend to be more ornamental vegetables. I'm sure I'm forgetting something. Snapdragons, I think, are kind of a little easier to interplant because they don't produce as much leaf area. And this is where I'm getting into my forestry background. But leaf area is the area that leaves occupy kind of in any given plane. If you think of, you took a slice across your garden and you looked down on it, how much space the leaves occupy is your leaf area. So if we compare, a good example in my book is I pair cosmos with cucumbers. And if you look at the frilly foliage of cosmos, it's practically invisible, right? It's very frondy. It's very light. It's never going to be a thug next to my cucumbers. And so I get the flowers and the whimsy of these beautiful plants, the flowering plants, next to my hardworking vegetable. And so that's a really nice combination of two taller plants. And it's really one of the only places I will put a taller growing flower next to a vegetable.
Well, here you are talking about cucumbers on National Cucumber Day. Jeff Robbins, our technical director, reminded me.
Oh, happy National Cucumber Day, everyone.
Mike in Coon Valley has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hello. I took some soil out of the ditch next to the roadway in front of our house rather than having the county dig their trench. And I used that fill up a raised bed that I acquired, and I'm gonna amend it with some organic material around whatever I plant. But what would be the best vegetable to plant in a spot like that?
And there's a lot of sand involved in that, Mike.
Yeah, it's what, you know, the township spreads a lot of sand, and over the years it accumulated in there. But it's it's sandy, let's put it that way.
Not total, but so it's a sandy type soil. Okay.
Here's what one thing I would recommend is maybe get it soil tested too, so you know. Yeah. If it's really sandy soil, I mean, I just think getting a soil tested, I don't know how sensitive you are to potentially having chemicals that might have been in there. Sandy soil things I think of immediately for planting would be potatoes or carrots, which both really like looser soil. But if it's sandy, I would be very generous with adding compost to it. I mean, I'm talking, don't hold back. 6 inches of compost, mix it in, go for it if it's really that sandy. Sand is great, except nutrients don't stay in it. Our soils tend to be heavier here where we are, so they're more clay, which is nice. but it also means the water doesn't move through as fast. But water moving through, Mike, means it's going to take something with it. So that's where really you can't, I don't think you can throw too much compost on sandy soil.
No, I think that's really good advice, Mike. Good luck with that, and just keep doing it every year too with the mulch and working it into your soil. I think that would be a very good thing to do. A bunch of questions here, emails. Gloria in Franklin wondered what variety of peas you like to plant and where you get your seeds. Where do you?
Oh, those are two good questions. I really love to grow I stagger my pea succession, which hopefully makes sense. I did this before I even knew I was doing it. So we've always grown snow peas and snap peas, and they're about 10 days apart in how they produce. So I grow sugar and snap peas. And then we grow Oregon giant snow peas. And I was gifted this year seeds from Row 7 Seeds, and they are a purple potted snow pea, excuse me, called the Beauregard. So I'm growing that too. And then we also generally, I ran out of seed this year, so I had to punt and run to the garden center. But I have really enjoyed PLS 595. I think that's what it was called. It's a pea variety, a very boring name. I don't know who named it. But these are those pea seeds were from Johnny's Seeds. So my seed buying really varies. And if I'm going to buy hybrids, and I do buy a lot of my brassicas are hybrids. Things like watermelons are often hybrids. I'm trying seedless watermelons for the first time this year. A lot of those seeds I buy from Johnny's. But then after that, I've been really spreading my net far and wide. I love adaptive seeds out of Western Oregon. They're out of Sweet Home, Oregon. And they do kind of, they're part of this open source seed initiative, which, not to go too far off the rails here, Larry, but it's just a really cool thing. And they've brought back varieties of things that are no longer sold because of hybrids. So it's like the antithesis to Johnny's in a way. I have two very successful cabbages that I grow from them. Premax is a green cabbage and Chieftain is a Savoy. And I've always thought to myself, well, I don't know, no one sells open pollinated cabbages. It must be because, like, I don't know why. And it's just, it's really, I think it's kind of a more of a sales thing than the fact that we can't grow them. These cabbages performed really well in my garden. It really has me starting to rethink how many hybrids I grow. I love Botanical Interests, which I can pick up a lot locally. Driftless Seed is out of, I guess it would be Southwest Wisconsin, out of the Driftless region. They're kind of a younger seed company, and they also specialize in open pollinated and kind of regionally adapted seeds. So they're a great company to check out. I've got some of their seeds this year. And Siskiyou Seeds in Southern Oregon. I mean, I shop kind of all over. I think there is a blog post in my garden resource library on my website of the different seed companies I enjoy supporting and kind of my reasoning.
Well, you go all over the place, and why? I guess why not?
Totally, it feels good to support, especially a lot of these seed companies are really small outfits, and so I like the idea of spreading my dollars around to different companies. It just feels good to support as many farmers as I can.
Well, I'd love to come to dinner at your place sometime, or even lunch or breakfast, because you have so many vegetables throughout the year. It's so much fun to have a chance to talk with you, Meg, about your book and about how you do it. And I know you've sold a lot of books already with this, but I hope you sell a bunch more, because it's a great book, and you're great to talk with. I hope we can do this again sometime.
Thank you so much. This was really fun. I'd come back anytime and chat gardening. So let's do it. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Meg. Meg McAndrews Cowden, and her book is titled Plant, Grow, Harvest, Repeat. It's a dandy book. I think you'll love taking a look at it. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mealer.